You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 20th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. He's one of the legends of his field, often referred to as the original madman. He's credited with helping to spearhead what became known as the creative revolution in American advertising. His work for Esquire magazine resulted in almost 100 covers, many of which were immortalized in an exhibition at New York's MoMA. And his unrivaled influence helped shape the political brand of one Mr. Robert Kennedy. His name, of course, is George Lois, and he joins me today on The Stack. On today's programme, we look back on the incredible list of achievements that helped make George Lois a true legend of his craft.
I was always more excited about artwork and design that sold, a cause and effect kind of communications. I don't really call myself a designer, I call myself a mass communicator.
From Lean Cuisine and I Want My MTV to Robert Kennedy and Esquire magazine, there are few people whose influence has so heavily shaped our perception of popular culture. That's all ahead today on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis programme. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. I'm joined today by someone who really epitomises much of what we've come to see as the overall brand of the 1960s and beyond. And for good reason, his work for Esquire magazine resulted in a series of iconic covers that helped make the magazine a lasting pop culture reference. But he also made his mark in the world of politics. As part of the team behind Robert Kennedy's political career, he played a key role in shaping the public perception of the man behind the name. George Lois, I'm delighted to say, joins us now from our New York bureau. George, a warm welcome to The Stack. I want to spend some time talking about your work in the world of political branding a little later, because that's something we're going to be talking about in a lot of detail here on The Stack in the coming weeks. But first, I'd like to go back to earlier in your career and your amazing work as an art director in advertising. Can you just tell us, what was it about that world, the world of art direction, of advertising, that first caught your attention and first drew you into it?
Well, I, of course, when I was a child, I started drawing. I drew all the time. I would get up in the middle of the night when I was 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. I would get up in the middle of the night when the whole family went to sleep and I would draw. And when I was graduating public school, I was very lucky. I had an art teacher came up to me and said, George, I'm sending you today to the High School of Music and Art. I had never heard of it. It was a brilliant school. I considered it the greatest school of learning since Alexander sat at the feet of Aristotle. And I got a design training there, which was second to none. Well, I graduated from that and I went to the Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, which was a terrible school. They didn't know what they were doing. They weren't nearly as terrific as my high school. My high school has, you know, Bauhaus-inspired teachers. But the only reason I didn't leave right away was because I met a girl there by the name of Rosemary Lewandowski the first day of school, and we've now been married for 65 years. So I wasn't about to leave her. But I went into the second year, and I was very lucky. And there was a teacher there by the name of Herschel Levitt who saw my work, and he said, why are you still in school? And I said, I want to get a job. My father's a florist, and he expects me to be a florist. And what he did is he immediately sent me to a woman art director, which was very, very, very unusual in those days, a woman by the name of Reba Socius, who had a studio. And I started working for her when I was 18 years old. She did promotion and some advertising, but I always was very excited, of course, about the history of art and, of course, graphic design. Mm. But I was always more excited about artwork and design that sold products, that sold people, a cause and effect kind of communications. So I don't really call myself a designer. I call myself a mass communicator.
Can I just ask you about that? Because it's interesting that, of course, graphic design, the discipline we understand it today, it used to be called commercial art, didn't it? And I wonder whether, do you think in a way that moniker was more accurate? Is that more how you saw it when you were setting out in that business?
Well, I'm not a commercial artist. I consider myself an artist, pure and simple. The best of my work is iconic. What happened after I worked for the Reba Associates, after 6 months I was drafted because it was during the Korean War. Mm. I had to go to Korea and fight with a racist army in a war of genocide, which I'm afraid a few of our wars have been. And when I came back, I was very lucky to work at CBS television with a great art director by the name of William Golden. He recognized it immediately that I wasn't the typical art designer, that my ideas were breakthrough, different, innovative, a little outlandish, and always very surprising. And I spent 4 years there. I loved it. I moved on to working with Herb Lou Ballin at Sutherland Hennessy, great graphic designer. And then Herb Lou Ballin, Lou Dorfman, and I, Lou Dorfman was from CBS Radio, came very, very, very close to starting an advertising agency. It would have been the second creative ad agency in the world, the first being Doyle Dane Burnback. But Lou Dorfman chickened out, and at that point, I think, I moved to Doyle Dane Burnback, spent one great, great year there, and felt that the world could easily take a second great creative agency. So I left Doyle Dane Burnback and started an agency by the name of Papert Koenig Lois, and it became the first ad agency in the world with an art director's name on a masthead. We became successful so quickly, and so when I told Bill Burnback I was leaving Doyle Dane Burnback, this great, great man, one of the most visionary men in the history of advertising, said to me, "George, there can't be more than one creative agency." He literally thought that his agency, which was a great agency, could be the only great one. I told him, "Bill, there can be 2, 3, 4, 5, as long as the creative people run the business and not the pencil pushers and not the account people and the non-talent." Mm. And he said, "Well, George, you certainly have the talent to do it, but I don't know if you're going to make it." Anyway, we made it. So we became hotter than Doyle Dane Burnback in that first year.
George, can I ask you a little bit about the scene then? You mentioned, you were a little bit of a visionary and you made this thing an incredible success. Were you aware at the time that it was a bit of a golden age, really, for that whole section of the business? Obviously, we look back at it now as a golden age. Were you aware at the time that something special was happening?
Yeah, of course. Well, everybody knew that Doyle Dane, which really opened, in the late 40s, early 50s, that was the only ad agency. Some people say Ogilvy. Ogilvy didn't come close to being a great ad agency. I mean, their restrictions on art direction and on visual power, was ridiculous. But what happened is when I left and I started that second creative agency, and it became immediately successful, within 2, 3, 4, 5 years, there were 5 or 6 other agencies: Mary Wells, Wellsrich Green, Scally McCabe Sloves, Carl Alley, etc. Before you knew it, within by 1962, 63, 64, that was the time called the advertising creative revolution. The creative revolution started when I started the second agency, and then 2 or 3 or 4 other agencies saw that what I was doing and said, "Gee, there could be more than one or even two creative agencies." And before you knew it, that was the golden age of advertising. It was the most heroic period in the history of advertising. And actually what happened, the reason the creative revolution took place and the reason Doyle Dane Burnback took place is, for the first time there was an ad agencies that understood that the art director should have the power to be the person who decides, literally decides, working with a copyright if he wished to or not. Before that, art directors were sitting in their room with their thumbs up their ass, waiting for a copywriter and an account man to come in and give them the copy and the strategy, and they would put it on an art director's desk, and the art director, if you can call him an art director, would do a layout. There was no synergistic power between the copy and between visual power. And Doyle Day and Dernbach changed that. When I went there, I did that plus, and most of my work was even more innovative and more outrageous. And when I started, as I said, Pat McCain Lois, and then Mary Wells came along, etc., that became the greatest period in the history of advertising.
Just talking to you about these experiences in those days, George, I know you said something before about how heavily researched ideas are, particularly latterly, and that only really mediocre ideas research well. And that the big ideas, the kind of creative leaps forward that you're talking about there, are always more difficult to sell. Do you think that's still true today, or has it become even more difficult to have really great ideas now?
My contribution, basically, as an art director and as a creative person, is that I don't strategize. I don't think about the unique selling proposition. I don't think about your positioning. I don't think about any of that. What I do is I talk to a client or a prospective client, and if I can talk to them, to important people there who know their stuff, I don't particularly want to hear their research. I don't particularly want to hear their market research. And I certainly don't want to hear a strict strategy they want to take place. Because I could go far above and beyond that power by going straight to find the big idea. And once I get that big idea, an idea that stuns, then I can take a look at what I did, and I put down 10 versions of a print ads, I'll put down 3 or 4 commercials, I'll put down promotion ideas. And once I take a look at what I did, I can look at what I did and pull a strategy out of it and tell that client that that was my strategy. And it's not, I'm not kidding anybody, it turns out to be a strategy that when you describe the strategy to them, they say at the beginning of a presentation, they say, my God, that's thrilling, but how could you possibly achieve that in an ad campaign? And I would show them my ad campaign. Mm. My strategy always came out of my big idea, because the big idea was intuitive, it was powerful, and I knew it would be so memorable that it would make, I could make $1 million look like $20 million.
And I'm sure once you made that look that way, people were a lot more relaxed, George, I'm sure. If we can just jump forwards a bit, George, I want to ask you just about some of your most celebrated work. You mentioned at the top the iconic works from your career, and I guess many people will look to the MoMA retrospective, which featured almost 40 of your incredible Esquire covers. Tell us a little bit about what the Esquire covers came to mean to you. Such a kind of lauded and long career. What place do those now, such famous images, what place do they occupy for you?
Many people still think that I was the art director at Esquire magazine. I started my ad agency in 1960. It was a great success. It was the beginning of the creative revolution. Then the editor of the magazine, Harold Hayes, who was fighting it out with a few other editors to get the top job, was watching my career, reading about me in the Times and in magazines all over America. The day he became the number one editor, he called me up and asked to have lunch with me. And when he sat down, he sat, and the first thing he said that came out of his mouth was, George, is there any way you can help me figure out how to do better magazine covers? And I asked him how he produced them now, and he said, well, first we have a meeting of everybody at Esquire after working on an issue, and we decided what article we should do a cover on. I said, yeah. He said, and then we would all, some of us would all come with ideas, and we'd choose 4 or 5, and we would comp them up, at which point I said, oh my God, group fucking grope. He said, what? I said, group groped. Is that the way you work with James Baldwin? Is that the way you work with Norman Mailer? No, of course not. So I said, what you have to do is you have to get somebody who doesn't work at Esquire to take a look at what's in an issue. And if there isn't an idea there for one, two, or even three great covers, you got a lousy magazine. And I started to write names of people down that he could possibly work with. And he said, no, wait a minute. And he had a Southern accent, by the way. He was a Southern liberal, which was an oxymoron in those days. And he said, you got to do me a favor, pal. He said, you got to do me one cover. So I said, okay, I'll do your cover. I said, when's the next one due? He said, well, it's due in 4 days, but I'll give you the one for the month after. I said, no, give me the one that's due in 4 days. And he said, really? I said, yeah. I said, well, tell me what's in the issue. He said, well, I have to go back and get all the story. I said, I don't want to read the stories. Tell me what's in the issue. He described, he went, well, there's this and this and this and this and this and this and this. And, this. And finally he mentioned, you know, there's going to be a championship fight between Floyd Patterson and Sonny Liston, and then he went on, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, the minute I heard that, I knew I would do a cover of showing Floyd Patterson, who was a 10-to-1 favorite, dead in the middle of a ring, because I knew that Sonny Liston was going to clean his clock. I knew he was going to kill him. So I produced a commercial where I got a boxer who looked like Floyd Patterson, same weight, et cetera, et cetera. We had photograph taken in the middle of an arena. He's laying dead in the middle of a boxing ring, and around him, everybody's left him. He was left for dead. And I sent it to him. The editor thought I was crazy. You're calling the fight. I said, yeah, I'm calling the fight, but you're wrong. Everybody, nobody agrees with you. I said, Harold, trust me, I'm right. And he had the guts to run it. In fact, I found out years later that even though he had just gotten the job, he threatened to quit when the publisher said that you couldn't run it. And he ran it. In fact, when the magazine came out, the publisher wrote in an editorial in his publisher's page, you see that cover? We don't agree with it. George Lois, the designer, did that. In any case, when the issue came out, it was a giant hit. It was everybody in America thought it was crazy. Liston was going to be destroyed by Floyd Patterson. And 4 or 5 days later, the fight took place. And Liston knocked out Floyd Patterson. And Esquire was considered a genius publication. And I went on to do them for the covers for Harold for almost the next 10 years. What I really loved about doing the covers was that they became a canvas for me. Not only a canvas for my graphic ability, but like a canvas for my political beliefs. I was against the Vietnam War, against racism. I'm kind of a left winger. And I was able to do 12 anti-war covers at a time when everybody in America thought the Vietnam War was an okay war. Can you believe that, you know? And again, people said, gee, what training did you have for that? I said, I had never done a magazine cover in my life. That didn't matter. It was a graphic design problem, but it was a thinking problem. You know, I've only done one music video, Bob Dylan's Joker Man, and Kurt Loder and most critics in America think that I did it in 1982, think that's still the best music video ever done. Every problem to me is a challenge to come up with something so innovative that you literally almost faint when you see the idea.
I guess, George, that speaks to the power of a great image. It speaks to the power of a really brilliant artistic mind behind it, and to the confidence, I guess, also of the client or the publisher, whatever it might be, to back good people, to have the freedom to be creative. Can I just turn that, though, to the sort of political realm? Because I know you've done a lot of work in the sort of political branding. That's obviously very hot at the moment with the election season in full flow, you know, where you are in the United States. Is there a secret, George, as well, to creating a good political brand, or is it all about being true to a great idea, as with the work you've already been talking about?
I look at political advertising, I look at the way I would look at selling any product. The name of the game is branding. And my attitude is that I have to brand the person. I have to make it so powerful and so simple and so exciting that the lights go on the minute you see it. Mm. You know, one of the first ones I did was for Robert Kennedy. What was interesting is he and his brother-in-law, Steve Smith, who was his campaign manager, literally came to me because of my Esquire covers. Mm. Jack was killed in November 1963. Actually, before Jack was killed, a couple of months before, Gore Vidal had an article a big article in Esquire where he was predicting that Jack would finish his first term, have a second term, and in 1968, which is after an eight-year term, Bobby Kennedy would become the next president, and he would have 8 years as a president. And I did a cover in March 63, which is a month before Jack got killed, of just a photograph of Jack Kennedy in his rocking chair, which was very well known at the time. And I just tore a picture of Bobby Kennedy and I placed it over Jack Kennedy's head. The headline said, Gore Vidal chooses the best man in 1968. So I think Bobby Kennedy and Steve Smith, his brother-in-law, obviously saw that cover. And then in June 1964, which is a year or more after Jack was killed, I did a cover, which was an article about the killing of Jack Kennedy. It's a wonderful photograph of him with and over it, a trompe-l'oeil, is a man's hand with a handkerchief drying tears, seemingly drying tears, coming from Jack Kennedy's eyes. And I think, again, Bobby Kennedy and Steve Smith saw that. A couple of weeks after they saw that cover, they came to my ad agency and asked me to do the advertising for Bobby Kennedy. So they came to me and they gave us the account on a Thursday. It was during the summertime, it was June 64, and I had sent a memo to everybody in my agency. I said, you know what, I never take vacations in my whole life, but I'm gonna take the next 6 Fridays off for the summer so I could spend the time with my family out at Fire Island, the beautiful vacation place nearby. And so the next day after I was given the account, I fly out with a seaplane, I land where my wife and my kids are. And when I got off the seaplane, my wife said, oh my God, George, everybody's calling from the agency. I said, what's the matter? She said, Bobby Kennedy and Steve Smith, I'd seen them the day before, up in arms because they said something about they just got a poll in, and the poll stated that 82% of the Democrats, which Bobby Kennedy was, believed that Bob Kennedy was a carpetbagger. Now, the carpetbagger is a term in America that says that you're not where you're from. He was running in New York State, and Bobby had no right to run in New York State. I mean, you need to live here and prove residence for many years to run for it. And what Bobby did is he somehow got the nomination. But 80-something% of Republicans, they found out, were saying, no way. I mean, we don't care who he is, he has no right to run. So I jumped the train went back to the agency, and everybody said, Bobby Kennedy and Steve Smith are waiting for you. They're going crazy. If 80% of Democrats think he's a carpetbagger and he has no right to run for president, what are they going to do? Going back on the train, I figured, well, it's a no-brainer. I went to them and I said, okay, listen to this. We're going to take a wonderful picture of Bobby with his sleeves rolled up, which he always used to do, and we'll take him looking like he's at his office at work, and there'll be a big headline that says, let's put Bobby Kennedy to work for New York. He and Steve Smith looked at me, and finally Steve Smith said, oh, you're saying that Bobby is a carpetbagger? Then Bobby said, but nobody gives a shit. I said, exactly. Let's put Bobby Kennedy to work for New York, which said to everybody in New York, who gives a damn? We need a kid, a young, strong liberal like that, whose brother was the president of the United States, who knows the ins and outs of Washington, etc. We got to put him to work for New York. And I said, so what we're going to do is we're going to plaster, this was in June. Political ad campaigns in those days for a November election would start in September. You know, now they start 2 years ahead of time. But they would start in September before the November. And this was June. And I said, and what we're going to do is we're going to plaster New York with posters and print ads that use that photograph. It just says, let's put Bobby Kennedy to work for New York. And they said, but it's only June. I said, no, right away. We're going to do it right away, right away. There were people there that said, no, you're going to blow the money too early. And I said, no. If you don't do this, when you get to September, you'll be dead as a doornail. Anyway, literally, there was a poll done 3 weeks after we ran posters all over New York State. The poll showed that only 14% thought he was a carpetbagger. And we went on and had an incredible win, you know, with 62% plurality. I branded him with his problem, solving his problem. You know, I said, you think he's a carpetbagger? Of course he's a carpetbagger, but who gives a shit? And everybody understood what I was saying. Everybody in America understood. I was saying, who cares? We need somebody great in New York. And everybody accepted it. And if Bobby wasn't assassinated in 68, it would be a different world today. We would have had 8 years of Bobby Kennedy. We wouldn't have had any Nixons in the world. We wouldn't have had any Bushes in the world.
Incredible. And again, it speaks to the power of great ideas and the power of great work, all of these things. George Lois, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you. That's George Lois, legend of the advertising and publishing world. Well, basically just the world, joining us on The Stack. That's all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks to our producer, Ben Ryland, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and editor, Clara Barn. Get in touch through the usual channels and catch up with the show or delve into the archive at monocle.com or via iTunes. This has been The Stack. We'll be back at the same time next week. From me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye.